get started because I think we have a lot to say about this. This is session 356, and the title is The Social and Economic Teachings of Mormonism, Social Justice is Alive and Well. My name is Becky Johns, and I welcome you to this session, and I'm very, very pleased to be able to introduce at least a little bit Warner Woodworth. Some of you know him very well, and I have a little more than what you have in your program, but we know him as a global social entrepreneur and professor at a Utah university, of which the name shall be not spoken of here. Author of
a parochial institution south of here. Let's get somewhat specific.
Okay. Author of 10 books and hundreds of articles, he sees his life's calling to reduce human suffering and empower the
poor.
The poor. Thank you. Was going to say empower the power. Doesn't make sense, but
empower the rich. Yeah.
Empower the poor and to empower those who are powerless. We're so grateful to have him today, and we. We'll probably have a few minutes for questions and answers afterwards. So be thinking of what you would like to ask. And when Warner's finished, we'll have a few minutes to open up the discussion for questions and answers. I'm going to turn the time over to him, but I think you may have to stand up here, Warner,
sure.
So for the tape.
Or are you taping this?
Yes.
Did I give approval? Did I sign something to tape this and send it to Cecil Samuelson? I hope not, but who knows? I do remember one time speaking at I remember a couple incidents. One was when Sunstone was meeting up at the U, and the guy came up after and introduced himself, and his first name was Ray, and he said, "I really like this. Can I get a copy of it?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I'll just go buy the tape then." I said, "Good." And I said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a spy for the church." And that's when I realized there was something going on that I wasn't even aware of. And later we finally figured all that out about what was going on. So usually when I'm at Sunstone, I'm trying to talk about poverty and apply to those who suffer and how we need to mobilize NGOs and get change agents out in the field and use microfinance and other tools to help women in poor villages get some kind of income generating opportunity and build schools for kids that have never had a chance to sit in a classroom and then supply those schools and stuff like that. But this time I decided, because I'm kind of frustrated with the moral and political and religious rhetoric in our country these days, I'm going a little off the deep end on that issue. So I'm hoping you'll bear with me. I'm gonna talk for half an hour, and then we'll let you cut loose and beat up on me for the next half hour. Is that okay? And I just want to say at the start that I'm trying to raise a bit of a question, a bit of a critique, a bit of a troubling questions and issues as I hear what's being said and I look at policies and changes going on in civil society. And I want to just kind of raise some issues. I'm going to try to share some quotes and some votes and some behaviors by people who apparently are members of our church, and I'm assuming you're a Mormon, maybe you're not, but claim to have a faith in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Savior, and yet they don't seem to espouse, and in fact, in some cases, they pretty heavily critique what's going on in our society against the teachings of the church and against any good Christian, if not good religious, set of values. So I'm going to lay some of that out. I'm going to try not to be too sarcastic. I'm going to try to just say, here's what I see, and here's what so-and-so is doing or saying, and juxtapose that against what I see the church's teachings are, to some extent. And I'm not even going to get much into the scriptures, but more into the practices and the advocacy and the preaching of modern-day Mormon leaders, from Joseph and Brigham to Thomas S. Monson today. So that's the plan. And then just open it up for your reactions, criticisms, corrections, which I'm sure there will be many. And we'll go from there. Turn of the century, 100 years ago, Protestantism blew the lid off religion in this country to some extent. There have been bits and pieces of this before, but they began to advocate what they call the social gospel, talking about and adhering to and using the teachings of Jesus in behalf of the poor, talking about the plight of the poor, and advocating especially New Testament, but also some Old Testament values around combating poverty, reducing crime, helping people get out of the slums, minimizing or eliminating, finally, child labor in this country, inequality. There was a huge religious peace movement going into World War I as it continued on into World War II, anti-war, anti-racism, anti-inequality, and so forth. That movement kind of peaked for a while, and then in the 60s it resurfaced in the civil rights movement and became huge and maybe in some ways much more massive and significant. And at the same time, as the civil rights movement started and the black issues began to, minority issues in terms of race began to gain the attention of the religious faithful in this country, open up the churches to the minority populations, especially of the South, but also the inner city. And then came along the women's movement, and some of that continued on into that other big and important social enterprise. In the 80s, if you read the little description, I was very intrigued to read the pastoral letter from the Catholic Bishops of America, in which they condemned capitalism and argued that we as Christians ought to draw on the true principles of the scriptures and focus on worker rights, on the dignity and importance of trade unions. They advocated worker ownership, and I was testifying in Congress and pushing the ideas and the methodologies of ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, and helping hundreds of companies and then thousands convert from being owned by distant shareholders on Wall Street or in Chicago, absentee owners, to instead give workers a piece of the action and find that they were more productive, the companies were more profitable, etc., when workers had shares of ownership in the firm they worked in. And that became a huge movement, and the Catholic bishops who saw us starting to do that in the late 70s got on board with that, and that moved to has continued to grow till there's about 12 million employees today in this country that own the companies they work for and have seats on boards in many cases and so forth. So the bishops were concerned about greed. They condemned the rich capitalists, the rich CEOs. They bemoaned the fact in their day, in the 80s, when U.S. executives of the Fortune 500 sometimes received total compensation packages as much as 30 or 40 or 50 times what the workers did. In 2009, the ratio of the Fortune 500 CEOs and chairmen of the boards, it was 452-1. And so we're going the wrong direction. And Brigham and others in their day, I'll talk about that in a minute, they also had big concerns about that. So they were interested, these Catholic bishops, in justice, in ethical and religious and moral responsibility in the firm. They saw the emerging and really the explosive growth of the U.S. economic system as one that in the U.S. and beyond ought to be more cautious and careful, helping the communities, being socially responsible, corporate social responsibility, CSR, which has become a hot term the last few years, moral enterprises that would benefit the whole of society, not just a few folks at the top. They also fought for trade unions or articulated that, and in the process of them moving in this direction, they would have been heavily influenced by liberation theology out of Latin America that then spread to Asia and Africa, where you had Christianity, the Bible, the Catholic Church having a significant role to play in politics, condemning the military coups, condemning the assassinations, condemning the juntas, in Brazil, juntas in Chile, etc. And their argument was that the church ought to be a voice and the Christians ought to practice, religious leaders and parishioners or members of the church ought to practice democracy, ought to be more transparent. The church ought to play a role in education, in healthcare. And of course, you know, they were building off the civil rights movement that was had been going on and the leadership of radical Catholics like Dorothy Day, who started the Catholic Worker, the Catholic Social Services, which had become an NGO in D.C. for a number of years. They were saying that ought to spread, that ought to deepen into the U.S. culture in terms of providing support and counseling and health benefits, etc., to the poorest in the slums in the inner cities of America, and it ought to spread around the world and help combat the oppression and the poverty, especially in the third world. About that same time and a few years before and increasingly since, other religions have moved in the same direction. ADRA, which is the Seventh-day Adventist NGO, humanitarian organization, one of the biggest and most successful in the world the last 20 years or so. ADRA started to take off from a little 1950s do-gooder kind of organization into becoming one of the world's premier aid agencies. And so you began to see more and more churches getting into this stuff. The last few years, what's been interesting to me, see the evangelicals, which were usually against this stuff, now embracing it, and you've got Jim Wallis and Sojourners movement and the movement, the strategies of many evangelicals to apply Christian principles in our community to work for social justice, to reduce racism and other kinds of things. And I'm not going to talk about what's been happening similarly with Judaism and other Christian churches with Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, etc., where they also now have their own humanitarian strategies. More recently, in the last decade or so, President Bush emphasized faith-based religious narratives and policies and bringing together the members of the religious community. Obama has built on that and said we need to open up the White House and Congress and our communities to the work and the services of those with religious beliefs and let them draw on their principles and unite them with the good of society. Obama also started this Social Innovation Fund 2 years ago. Gives out $50 million a year in funds to community-based social justice organizations, whether they're religious or secular, and argues for the importance of religious commitment in improving society. So that's what's been going on in the larger movement. Now, within Mormonism, second theme here, I guess, is that the church has been moving in this direction. And it really started in 85, 86, when, like today, There was then and there is now this huge crisis in the Horn of Africa. And in the mid-80s, the brethren were fighting and debating and trying to figure out what should the church do as an institution and what should members do to address those concerns. Up until then, the philosophy had been, by and large, a couple of exceptions, World War II, aftermath, and after the earthquake in Guatemala, when they agreed to send aid that was shipped by the U.S. government under the condition it would go to all who needed it, not just Mormons. So there was that kind of philosophy and a couple of big events where Mormon resources and welfare benefits and materials served everyone. But by and large, the church had its welfare program for its members, and the focus was on that. But in the early 80s, the debate started really heat up about, should we help others? And on the one side, you can imagine, there were some of those brethren arguing, we're just a little church, and we don't have much money, and we have limited resources, and let's focus on doing what we can for our people and build Zion in our own communities. And then on the other side, and I'm going to the right for that perspective, just help Mormons, on the left, those leftists in the church office building argued, hey, let's talk about Christianity. We ought to help anyone who needs. Yeah, we can't solve all the problems. We can solve some. If we just help our members, A, is that really the best we can do as Christians? And B, what are the unintended consequences of that, the potential repercussions? If the neighbors are getting aid from the Mormons, the flood's being cleaned up, the house is being built, the well's being dug, the school's established for Mormon kids in the village, but not for their neighbors that are Catholic or Muslim or whatever. And so that debate occurred for a number. It had been kind of below the surface, but in the 80s, as this crisis occurred in Africa, as it grew, the debate grew more and more intense. Eventually, some members, and I'm assuming some of you are here, started writing Salt Lake and saying, I gave my tithing to the Catholic Social Services, Catholic Relief Services. I gave my funds to USAID that I would have given in tithing, but I'm going to the bishop to declare I'm a full tithe payer. But since you guys aren't helping in Ethiopia, and where else was it? Can't remember now. Anyway, East Africa, I'm transferring my funds to those who will respond and use my tithing to reduce the struggles of the poor. And that sort of shook things up, and that increased the debate. And again, on the one side, some of those folks in Salt Lake were saying, well, if we channel money to that, we won't have enough for our own welfare program. And several members proposed we have a church fast, special day, not a typical Sunday, but a special day just for East Africa. And the brethren debated that and said, if we do that, they'll fund monies just for that, but then we'll have less fast offerings for our own needs, for our own people here in the U.S. or Mexico or whatever. But ultimately, they did it. They held a special fast, and lo and behold, I think they brought in $9 million. And then the next month, fast offerings in the church grew even more than they ever had. And they said, wait, this is viable. We can do this. And they had a second fast a year or so later, and the Canadians did something similar, and the European saints had their own special fast. Anyway, that led to the creation of humanitarian services of the LDS Church. Since then, we've seen other things unfold. First humanitarian services, then Latter-day Saint Charities to facilitate and really build this out. Then Perpetual Education Fund to help RMs have a future, and that movement and those programs have been escalating ever since, and the church now spends $100 million plus every year on these kinds of projects within not just to help our own saints, but to go beyond that. And of course, last year the church issued its new fourth mission or purpose, which was defined in the new church leadership manual, in addition to saving the dead, perfecting the saints, and doing missionary work. There's this new fourth purpose to care for the poor and needy. In other words, yeah, we're going to save the dead and do temple work. We're also going to try to save the living, save more of the living. So that strategy developed. And the new training materials argue heavily for our capacity to reach out, and we hear from President Hinckley, we've heard over the last decade plus, and more recently President Monson about that. So that's the context, okay? And yet, with these changes occurring, and the church calling 400 couples to be inner city missionaries in Salt Lake, and to change their philosophy, which used to be, let's give people what they think they need, to tell us what you want, and we will help you get that according to their wants and needs, as the DNC suggests, and Karl Marx and others suggest. So there is a little difference there. It's not much. I always try to use some Brigham quotes in my MBA classes. I don't tell them. I just read some Brigham and Joseph Smith quotes at the beginning of a semester and ask them with each one, who said this? And it's always Vladimir Lenin, Karl Marx, or whoever. And then I say, no, that's Lorenzo Snow. No, that's Brigham Young. And half of them go out and leave the church, I'm sure. I always feel bad, but then I warn them. Just trying to give you the truth. They hate me, and my teacher ratings go down from the first day on. Okay. So in that, with that little bit of history of social justice in the larger Christian churches of the country and the emerging philosophy and strategies of Mormonism, then we've got these interesting things going on in society today. One is presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who apparently is a Mormon, at some point was a state president. As I kind of looked through some of his speeches, I was intrigued by how anti-worker he is and anti-union. And I read these interesting analyses of how many companies Bain Capital bought, of which he became a multimillionaire with many of them, and then they gutted the firms, pulled out the resources, whatever they could, shut the plants down, and laid off tens of thousands of workers. And I couldn't quite reconcile that with other Mormons, like Kay Whitmore, who was CEO of Kodak in Rochester, New York, who, when the Wall Street and the shareholders pressured him to lay off tens of thousands of their workers, he resigned in protest as CEO and said, that's inhumane, I can't do that. He had a lot of stake members in his state there that worked for Kodak. And he said, my religion won't let me do that. Mitt didn't have that problem. Mitt was anti-TARP, said Detroit's a lost cause, versus his dad, George, who said, we ought to be using the gospel to help the inner cities. Mitt writing them off. Pro-corporation, pro-cutting taxes to business, and also more subsidies or tax cuts, I guess, for the wealthy. Likes vouchers to replace the public school system we have. He wants to close the Department of Education. He fully supported the Iraq War. He issued his new book. What's it called?
No Apologies.
No Apologies. He's saying Obama is too nice and too humble with other world leaders. We shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be humiliated by any of them. We shouldn't recognize them. We shouldn't shake hands with Brother Chavez, Hugo, of my country, Venezuela. We should not sit down with them. We should not negotiate with them. we should never admit to anything wrong we've done in American history. He's now pro-guns. He used to be anti-gun. Now he's pro-guns, pro-NRA. And I think his track record on that is pretty substantial, because he said he used to go out and let his kids shoot jackrabbits with their 22. So he's now a big wildlife hunter. Of course, he's anti-immigration, doesn't want the DREAM Act or other benefits for immigrant children. He wants a balanced budget amendment to the inspired Constitution. And I guess, so anyway, that's Mitt. And I apologize in advance to Mitt. Oh, I have to do that. He took $5 million out of Salt Lake Valley last time he ran for president, which would have gone to these NGOs and humanitarian organizations we build out of Utah. And then there was a certain promise made. He was done with politics, and his family was setting up its own NGO. And he was going to spend the rest of his life doing humanitarian work, and that lasted for about a year. Now he's going to take another $5 million. Then there's Senator Russell Pierce. Who is he?
Arizona legislator.
Arizona legislator. Fifth generation Mormon down there. Buddies with Maricopa Sheriff Joe Arpaio in beating up on prisoners. Calls Obama a jihadist for supporting humane immigration policies in our country. He used to work for the Arizona State Motor Vehicle Division, but was fired for unethical practices when he started tampering with Mexican driver's licenses and changing them so he could then arrest them or have them arrested by the then sheriff of the area. And then he worked for Joe for a while. With Governor Graham's support, he was the main advocate for Prop 1070, to empower the government of Arizona to stop and search suspects, require proof of citizenship at all times. He wanted to change the Constitution. Again, I thought it was an inspired Constitution, but he wants to change it, get rid of the 14th Amendment so that immigrant children born in the U.S. cannot stay here and become American citizens. Calls the people of Mexico invaders. More recently, they've discovered his past ties to various white racist groups and hate groups in Arizona. He's now facing corruption charges for illegally getting $40,000 in benefits tied to the Arizona football programs for hotels, travel, luxury meals for his family that state law prohibits. He wants to cut Medicare for the poor. And finally, I discovered was sued by his wife back in the 1980s for domestic violence, in which he grabbed her by the throat and threw her to the ground. I guess it was home evening and he was just practicing his priesthood authority. I'm not totally sure on that. And because of these unethical and illegal and extremist views, he's the first Arizona elected official to ever face recall, and they needed 3,000 signatures to get it on the ballot for this fall. They have 10,000, 9,000 of which have been confirmed as legitimate, so he'll have more time to do his home teaching once that happens, I guess. Maybe my favorite Mormon, and I'm just highlighting four people. Another one is Glenn Beck, Brother Beck. Brother Beck, they say he's a Mormon. He says he's a Mormon. I still am not convinced. And when I saw in the BYU Daily Universe this past couple days, that he's also a BYU alumni, then I was pretty sure he's faking it. Because I know he never got a college education, at least a real college. Better not get snide on that. Okay, so he criticizes so many religious groups. Last year he said, I beg you, look for the word social justice or economic justice on your church website. If you find it, run away as fast as you can. Social justice, economic justice, those are code words for communism. Am I advising people to leave their church? Yes, he exclaimed. Later that same show, he held up cards with a hammer and sickle on one side and a swastika on the other. He said, communism and Nazism both have the same philosophy in America. They're called social justice. Such churches are dangerous. So I'm assuming Brother Beck has gone to his stake or ward ecclesiastical leaders and asked to be excommunicated from the social justice church, which he espouses or says he belongs to. Many other churches have been embarrassed and felt attacked and accused by that political ideology of hate, which I think we as Latter-day Saints embrace, at least in the teachings of the church, if not fully our practice. He condemns government services for the elderly, the poor, the unemployed, children who lack food and nutrition, as well as our health care changes that are coming, as well as the health care system we already have, if we have one. And he argues that people should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Such doctrines aren't new. They were espoused by British sociologist Herbert Spencer, who was the guy who phrased the word social Darwinism. It wasn't Darwin. It was Spencer arguing, as we have in some of our scriptures, the philosophy of a guy named Corahor, who taught that the management of the creature was the important thing, and therefore every man prospered according to his genius, every man conquered according to his strength, and whatsoever a person did, a man did, was no crime. And we could add to the philosophies of Hitler and U.S. robber barons and others. Beck isn't just against the term or some of these practices of social justice. He, and I'm so sure you've all seen him on TV, when he screeched that President Obama hates white people, he's a racist. Democrats on different days are fascists, communists, socialists, or Muslims. Take your pick. The wealthy should be protected and esteemed. They're the role models. You know, it's interesting the way terminology is shifted by some of these political and ideological right-wingers. It's no longer about, you know, lowering tax breaks or lowering the taxes, giving tax breaks to the rich or the wealthy. They're no longer called wealthy. They're called job creators. Have you noticed that lately? Those big companies don't create jobs. Small enterprises, small business creates the jobs. And they still have tax breaks. But he's attacking the very notion of the wealthy having to pay a larger share. Unions are of the devil. I just kind of juxtapose Glenn Beck against Joseph F. Smith, who taught it's extremely hurtful for any man enjoying the gift of the Holy Ghost to harbor a spirit of envy, malice, retaliation, or intolerance against his fellow man. So I've got Brother Beck off my chest here. How long are we going? 4:15? Mm-hmm. Okay. Last case is the Utah legislature, as opposed to the hard-nosed Arizona legislature. They seem to be pushing the exploitation of wilderness areas for big oil and other corporations. They've formally gone against the new health care programs and legislation that's been passed, known as Obamacare. They've finally given us a state gun in Utah so that we and the country of Mozambique, where they had a civil war using AK-47s for 20 years killing each other, were the only two political entities of any import that have their official state guns. They you know, we have in the scriptures these notions about confessing our sins, about being open, about being transparent, etc. Our legislature passed HB 477 this last session to shut down access to public documents and information to make them more secret, more inaccessible, known as GRAMA. Finally had a big public outcry and they backed off on that. They call for and have passed legislation to manage immigration issues, HB 116, which requires the registering of immigrants for jobs by employers and a guest worker program. That motion, I don't know, how many of you are from Utah and are up to speed on that? Okay, so you know, at least as I understand it, that legislation went, got passed. Then the Republican Party's conventions in Utah County, Salt Lake County, and I think up here, Weber County, did they not vote to kill that bill? Is that correct? I know the first Salt Lake and Utah County, they voted to get rid of it, and my guess is we'll be facing lots of a long battle about all that. And yet on the other hand, you've got the church saying we need to be full of love for the immigrants. We shouldn't break up families. The church doesn't ask their ethnicity or their
citizenship
for church callings or going to the temple or sending their kids on missions. And yet there's this huge prayer. You know, they signed this Utah Compact, which began to be praised around the country as a model of, you know, getting stuff on the table, being more explicit, monitoring the situation on the one hand, and yet also seem to be more protective of families and more humane in treatment of minorities. I don't know where all this will go. Sometimes it seems to me state legislators in Utah or state officials act somewhat against the very principles of Mormonism that we read in the scriptures and the teachings of our leaders. Governor Herbert, for instance, a few months ago turned down $100 million federal money that would be given to 20,000 families where the head of the house was unemployed because he felt that would just prolong their search for a job. They would delay getting a job. Senate President Mike Wadups tried to justify this. The governor said, we just don't want federal control. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? We're a federal territory. We get a lot more money from the feds than we put in as a state. But Wadups, backing the governor, trying to justify it, said, look, this $100 million would be tax money. People need to be weaned off the government paying for everything. If we extend the benefits, these people will never be motivated to get back to work. So he saw that as a welfare handout. Other activities by elected Utah officials included such things as, these are all just proposals in the last year or two. Let's eliminate the 12th grade. That'll save us money in the public school system. We can get these kids out the door and whatever. Let's get rid of humanities education in Utah's colleges. Get rid of arts, literature, poetry, music, all that wasted stuff that they call liberal arts. They don't even like that term. And let's be focused on business and engineering and use our colleges and educations to help people get jobs and screw the quality of life or whatever. One official initiated legislation last year to require companies during the Christmas season, during the month of December, to greet employees and greet customers in the shopping mall or whatever by saying Merry Christmas rather than saying Happy Holidays. That should be a piece of legislation practiced in Utah. My friend and neighbor in my own district, Chris Hera, who used to be my old student, tried to get me fired when I was his professor at an ecclesiastical and parochial institution south of here in the master's program in the business school. has initiated legislation last year, and I think he'll push it further this year, to ban tenure, faculty tenure at all Utah universities. And one of his colleagues is pushing for the teaching of creationism in public schools. So I don't know. I don't know if these people are just ideologues. I don't know if they how familiar they are with the scriptures or the teachings or the brethren or whatever. Maybe they're theologically illiterate. I really don't know. But let me just run through real quickly for 5 minutes. Well, I don't even have that much time. But here are a few Mormon social justice core values. Maybe we start with Spencer Kimball in 1978 lifting the priesthood ban on blacks. Or maybe we go to President Brown of the First Presidency 15 years before saying it's a moral evil for any person or group to deny any human being the right to gainful employment, to full educational opportunity, to the privilege of citizenship. We call on all men everywhere, both within and outside the church, to commit themselves to the establishment of full civil equality for all of God's children. Then you've got President Tanner and Marion G. Romney making similar statements on wealth and greed. You've got George Q. Cannon, who argues the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few powerful individuals threatens us with greater danger today than anything that can ever be done by outsiders. God does not design there should be classes among us, one class lifted above another. And you're familiar, I guess, with the 1875 proclamation on the economy, some call it, others just say it's an epistle, where they argued about the wondrous, what they called wondrous, meaning scary in their day, accumulation of power and wealth in a few big corporations and a few rich families. Orson Pratt, an inequality of property is the root and foundation of innumerable evils. It's not the love of money, it's inequality, he says, that keeps asunder the feelings that should exist among all people of God. Inequality is a principle originated in hell. It's the root of all evil. It's inequality in riches that's the great curse. And Brigham said, we should take a moral view, a political view, and see the inequality that exists in the human family. It's the unequal condition of mankind. The Latter-day Saints will never accomplish their mission until inequality shall cease on the earth. Lorenzo Snow said, if we have extra money, we should use it to help the poor get employment and see before them a competence and the conveniences of life. Peace, David O. McKay, the mission of the church is to transform society so the world may be a more peaceful place. Heber J. Grant, J. Reuben Clark, the church is and must be against war. It cannot regard war as a righteous means of settling international disputes. These should and could be settled, the nations agreeing, by peaceful negotiation and adjustment. And then a great sermon by President Kimball against the U.S. missile policies out here in the western deserts, where he condemned us for being warlike people. And talked about loving our enemies. The environment, Ezra Taft Benson, the outward expression for a reverence for God, for life, and our fellow men take the form of things like littering, heedless strip mining, heedless pollution of water and air. And of course, he also condemned profit making at exorbitant rates by companies and people. John Taylor on the Good Society, we're engaged in a work God has set his hand to accomplish, to introduce correct principles of every kind, principles of morality, social principles, social justice, good political principles. The Lord has called us to be his co-adjustors or adjusters and co-laborers in the fields of the workers. Brigham Young, attend to those things which are temporal, otherwise your faith will be in vain. Doesn't do any good, he's basically arguing, to just preach the gospel. You must nurse and wait upon the needy and prudently administer medicine and food to them. To speak of these things as part of my religion. And Joseph F. Smith on the prophet Joseph, the church that doesn't have the power to save its people in this life would never have the power to save them in the next. women's rights, Spencer Kimball and Marion G. Romney and N.L. Tanner, women as daughters of God should have, without discrimination, every political, economic, and educational opportunity. On charity, Parley Pratt, I expect the saints to give money for support of the poor. If they don't do it, their Mormonism, their religion is vain. We preach a religion which very materially affects men's purses. A religion that doesn't affect men's purses is worse than none. I don't know. I got too many of these. Full employment. Brigham called for the wealthy to use their resources to create jobs for others, to not invest in minerals. He would not like Brother Beck's call for us to put our money into gold and precious minerals. Even though apparently the exchange rate's pretty good and gold's value's going up. But he and Lorenzo Snow, who gave this great sermon at the beginning of the 20th century in January 1900, said we ought to open up our purses and channel all the resources we have into creating jobs for our brothers and sisters. John Taylor also said the job of a stake president is first and foremost to create employment for every man, woman, or child in their stake that seeks one. Humanitarianism, President Hinckley. There are people, not a few, whose circumstances are desperate, who cry out for help and relief, who are hungry and desperate, who need help. Brothers and sisters, I would hope, I would pray that each of us would resolve to seek those who need help, who are in desperate and difficult circumstances, and reach and lift them in the spirit of love. So it looks to me like this whole notion of Mormon society, of a good economy, of Zion, has to do with reducing inequality, with reaching out, using our stewardship, practicing the principles of consecration, and building collectively together, or working collectively together to build a better community, to provide opportunities for all. And of course, that was not just the view in the early days of the Restored Church, but also in the 1930s, and it's continued to grow with these humanitarian funds and perpetual education funds and so forth. So that's my perspective on this, and you can go down. I've got statements here from Brigham and President Hinckley and President Monson, who said, today in lands far away and right here in Salt Lake City, there are those who suffer hunger, who know want, who are acquainted with poverty. Ours is the opportunity and the sacred privilege, if not duty, to relieve this hunger, to meet this want, to eliminate this poverty. When he was first sustained in General Conference after President Hinckley's passing away, he got all the general authorities together at that conference in a private session, said, I have just one question for you as ministers of Jesus Christ. Who have you rescued today? And that's become a major thrust of his leadership, and of course that's the rescue is the title of the biography about him. So I'm just wondering, that's the theology. Some of this is what the church is doing. Some of this is what Latter-day Saints are doing, initiatives they're taking to work for some degree or other of social justice, whether it's environmental justice, labor justice, economic justice, community justice. I'm wondering what your thoughts are, criticisms, suggestions. Where am I off the deep end? Yeah.
Why are we?
Tell us who you are.
My name is Kay Gaysford from Gilbert, Arizona.
Hi, Kay.
I'm wondering why we don't hear more about this fourth mission in this handbook you mentioned for emphasizing ministering to others.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I hear some of the brethren say we don't want to make a big push on it right away. So it's been a year and a half. I'm assuming we'll see more of that happening. I keep floating my little proposals like I did with Perpetual Education Fund. It took 10 years before they bought into it. But my latest thing is family self-reliance loans. And, of course, they're all saying, no, we're not going to do that. But I don't know how else the poor are going to be helped in these third world places without some kind of small amount of capital, because they're never going to get a job from big companies coming in or foreign investors, because that's not happening. So they've got to invent their own jobs and pick themselves up, so-called, by their bootstraps. But they don't have the $50 or $100 to start it. So I don't know. But, you know, you hear a lot of them talk one-on-one and in stakes and so forth about this. But there's not a big, which I sort of thought would happen, there'd be this big announcement, this new fourth mission. They're not doing it so far. Yeah.
Well,
who are you?
Brad Carmack.
Hi, Brad.
You mentioned that big companies don't create jobs that the small businesses do. Isn't that a suspect claim? Don't big companies innovate as well and ways that contribute to economic growth?
Yeah, it's a debatable point. On the one hand, I'd say yeah. And by the way, let me just hand out. I brought some handouts about some of this stuff in terms of how to practice this. Oh, thank you so much. Here, let me give you a few more. I don't know. Maybe you need more. Big companies have the possibilities, and some of them are very innovative. I mean, what we hear this week, Apple now has more billions, I think 82 billion, more than the 77 billion the U.S. government has today. So that they have resources. In some cases, they have great new technologies. In lots of cases, they grow by buying these small innovative firms. And they tend many times, I argue, and some of the data supports that, it's not across the board, but some data suggests they do these acquisitions and then buy the technology and get rid of the workers in these small entrepreneurial firms so they don't have the competition. And if you look at the job growth in the Fortune 500 per firm versus the medium-sized businesses and small businesses, the big boys hardly create any jobs. So part of me says it's a bit of a mythology about that. Yeah, back there.
Your talk is titled Social Justice is Alive and Well, and I just kind of wonder.
Yeah.
You know, look, I mean, these quotes that you gave are wonderful, you know, and I really appreciate that. But, I mean, if they were to be said today in general comments, they'd probably be voted out of the church in that very moment. Or, called socialists or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, the Somalian drought.
So let me just say, it's a conclusion, alive and well, parentheses, hopefully. Alive and well and growing, that's my dream. Is it what it should be? No, to me it's not. But anyway, yeah, talk about Somalia.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, you know, the Somalian drought, we've been knowing it's going on for a while.
Yep.
The church has not said anything as far as I can tell.
Yep.
And, you know, just within the last...
Who are you?
I'm Andrew Isaac.
Andrew, okay. Thank you.
And,
yeah.
Why such reticence on such an important issue? You know, 12 million people right now being affected. It seems like now more than ever would be a perfect time.
So let me suggest what you can do. Yeah, it could be a perfect time. The realities are, well, let me tell you what you can do first. You can go to your ward tomorrow, if you're practicing Mormon, or if you're not, that's even better. Go to your ward and get the little slip, the donation slip, and where it says other, write Somalia or Ethiopia crisis or Horn of Africa, and write a check for $100 or $1,000. In your case, $5,000. I'm sure you look like a student, so and see what happens, and see if they'll send it to Salt Lake under other. And you can also write or email the Humanitarian Fund or church welfare, or your favorite general authority. Mine just died this week. Randy Hanks. But he'll be pushing from the other side of the veil for this. Write them and say, and include a check to them, saying, please just use this for East Africa, and see what happens. I can tell you what will happen, but I want you to do it. Because that's one way, and you have your friends and have your family, extended family. You have your, you have your parents. You get your neighbors. And try to grow this. So that's a couple things you can do. It's not going to change it overnight, but I think it will lead to change. Organize a group in your ward and have a fast for Africa. And accumulate the money and give it to ADRA. Adventist or the Catholic Relief Services. Do that. I've talked with the several of the brethren and talked to the humanitarian staff, and they're saying this is too scary and too crazy, and there's so much corruption and so much violence, hardly anybody's helping there. You can't get the aid in, and we're not going to just write checks and ship stuff over there and have it stolen like you read in the news this week in Ethiopia. They're taking that stuff, selling it, and buying guns with it. And so it's very complicated. It's much worse politically in terms of access to guns and weapons and pirates and crazy folks. Much worse than it was in the mid-80s. So it's complicated. I believe, and I have full faith, I'll bear my testimony, the church will get into that at some point. But there's 12 million people dying today, and there's no easy solution for the U.S. government or the U.S. Marines or our little Mormon church to make a difference. So, yeah.
Boyd Erickson.
Boyd.
I once had an Elskhorn president who told me, well, God doesn't care about starving children in Africa because he sees the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, how much do you think...
I have friends like that.
How much is our theology and how our theology is emphasized and taught encourage members to dream of their mansions above instead of getting up and doing something more?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big problem. We need to confront that when that is said in Sunday school gospel doctrine class or in the quorum. And I think we need to say, look, Joseph said the church that doesn't have the power to save its people here will never have the power to save them in the next. We've got to do this. We're not going to have a millennium that's going to come down from heaven and fix everything. We got to prepare the world for that millennium. We've got to look at the temporal as well as the spiritual. We're losing baptisms in lots of countries because people can't even feed themselves or send their kid to school. So as Harold B. Lee said, if we think we can go into these poor countries and help and convert the people and assume that'll solve everything, we might as well throw our hats in the air because they're not going to stay in the church. Or Matthew Cowley down in the South Pacific said similar things. Yes, sir. Brother.
Richard Edgley.
Richard. No, you're our...
I'm not Richard Edgley.
You're Stan.
Dale Reese.
Dale, sorry.
The Bishop Edgley, the presiding bishopric, is in our ward. And just a month or so ago, he was telling our priesthood group that there's going to be a change in the donation slips coming up shortly.
Yeah.
And he didn't get specific, but he said they're still kind of working on it.
Yeah.
It all has to do with that humanitarian thing. So it's going to... I wouldn't be surprised to see some more specificity in that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it will. And, of course, he's one of the few who's announced caring for the poor and needy as the fourth mission. He said that 2 months before the church officially acknowledged it.
Yeah.
And so he's a pretty outspoken person. And those brethren in the bishopric are big drivers for this movement.
And I think another thing that he said is that, you know, we hear a lot that, well, the church just does this for good publicity. But he was saying that stuff that I didn't even know we're doing.
Yeah,
you know, the vaccinations and ongoing...
Water projects.
Yeah.
All literacy. Huge money's going in. You hear about wheelchairs and stuff like that. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And I am grateful that they're not only doing it, but they're not using it as PR strategies and trying to baptize people based on that. It's interesting, there was a recent discussion with some of the First Presidency with some big donors to the church in which they were asked, what's the greatest missionary tool we have today in the church? And you know, where I'm from, we got Jimmer Fredette, right? We got BYU football. We used to have BYU football. And I thought they were going to say that because you hear that on campus every day. They said, well, there's top three things. The third thing is BYU athletics. That's the number three program that helps grow the church around the world and improve our reputation. What do you think number two is? Number two is missionary work. It ranks second for converting the world. It's only number two. Number one, they said, humanitarian services of the saints and of the church. And you know, I'm hoping out of this group several of you will start your own family foundations or projects and do something in Cambodia or East Africa or Ogden, Utah. President Hinckley, one of the statements I've loved about from him about this kind of work is he said, I worry that we have over-institutionalized our service to the poor and argued you and I as individuals, as Latter-day Saints, as livers of the gospel, practitioners of the gospel, I guess we're not livers, but practitioners of the gospel, can be inspired and find needs and address them. He's saying the church can't do it all. It's not that rich. It's not that big. They don't have all the answers. So a couple other comments. Are we out of time?
We're
I guess we are.
Let's have this in right here.
One. Who's that? Yes, sorry. You are?
Kay Healy from
Kay.
Ogden.
Hi, Kay.
North Ogden. I just wanted to ask, I have done that, write different emergency locations on my humanitarian for a lot of time, but you said see what happens. I never know if it actually goes there.
Yeah.
Do they follow through and send it where it...
If you send it to Salt Lake, at the end of the year, you will get the printout. And if you say, I want it to go to the villages of Fiji where I serve my mission, at the end of the year, you'll get a statement back saying you gave $50 or $500 to the villages of Fiji.
So it'll actually specify that.
Okay. Well, they specify that's where it's gone. Now, did they use it wisely? Was it the best uses? I don't know. But what I'm hearing is interesting. I'm hearing from a lot of the church officials and in the bureaucracy, as well as some of the brethren, that if we're not doing something someplace and you find a good, reputable NGO that you trust, that's transparent, that is not going to put most of the money into executive salaries or computers or whatever for their offices, you'll be blessed for donating to them. You don't need to give it just to the church.
My other comment is when I retired 2 years ago, I knew I wanted to do humanitarian work overseas.
Yep.
Out of the United States, rather. But I could only do it for 2 months because of some medical reasons.
Okay.
So I just thought, I'll start looking for something.
Yep.
And I wanted something that's kind of related where there might be other Mormons.
Good.
I want you to know, before I even started looking, I was flooded with them. There are Mormons doing humanitarian stuff everywhere.
Yep. Yep.
And it's amazing, all over the world.
Yep.
I ended up going to Guatemala and teaching English, which was
fantastic.
Something I could do. But
with which organization?
No.
Is it the Rose Foundation that has the schools down there?
Rose Foundation.
Oh, fantastic. Or Choice, it could be. There's a ton. I've listed a few here. Some of that is microcredit, and I love that because it's the gift that keeps on giving. You give $100, that goes out as a loan to a family. They start a little business. They pay it off with interest. Then that money turns around, and they give that person a $200 loan, and then $400. And little by little, some of these people are moving themselves out of poverty. But is it Ruth?
Oh. Rose Foundation.
No, what's your name?
Kay.
Kay, sorry. We're starting a new NGO. We have one for teenagers, one for college kids called Help International, one for single older members in their 30s and 40s that are on Wall Street or work for AID or DC's, something in Washington, and they want to go do stuff. And then there's the ones for families to go for short trips, take your teenagers or whatever, and do 10, 15, 20 days. We're now starting one for retirees, older single or married individuals who've retired and want to do what you want to do. And I haven't got a name for it, but my email's there. If you have a name, email me with it, because we're going to start putting that together and incorporate as a 501c3. And we're planning to ask people to serve church missions once, because we don't want to be competing with Salt Lake. But then after that, they can go do a two-month mission or a four-month or a three-year, or that they could go and come back when the baby of their daughter's born, or so-and-so and the family's got cancer. They can leave and come back. They can whatever. And we're going to set it up so they're in safe environments. They can put their money in this nonprofit just like they can with the church, get tax refund for doing it, and pick and choose and pray and get their own inspiration for what they could be doing around the world. So we'll start that. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for coming.